The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
Welcome again, everyone. It's really good to be here tonight. I'm really grateful that Robert Jackson was willing to come visit again and teach. Many of you know of Roger Jackson, and it's amazing how many former students pass through Common Ground stores. People say how much they got out of Roger Jackson's classes at Carleton College, where he's been teaching for quite a while now. Were you there when Ajahn Chandoko was a student?
Yeah, that was just for a brief time then. No, he's a student of whom I'm proudest.
Some of you know, Ajahn Chandoko's been a teacher now probably 6 or 7 years. He's been coming. He's an abbot of a monastery in New Zealand. In any case, Roger Jackson's here tonight. He's talking. The title is "Metta is Not All You Need: Love and Compassion in Buddhist Traditions." And Roger Jackson's specialty is the religions of South Asia and Tibet. And again, Roger, thank you so much for coming. It's great to have you here again.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm very, very pleased to be asked back. This is a wonderful space. And I'm not sure I can do the space justice, let alone all of you justice, but I'll do what I can. When Mark asked me to take on this topic of love and compassion, I was hesitant at first. I think I can't speak for everybody here, but I know that when I first got interested in Buddhism, it was primarily in what we might call the wisdom traditions. If something was about emptiness, then I was all over it. And the meditations on love, compassion, and other allied emotions, if you will, were not always the easiest thing for me to relate to. Maybe that's because I'm a bit intellectual and a bit academic by nature. I don't know. We don't need to get into the psychology of it. But the more I thought about Mark's suggestion for a topic, the more I liked it. And I'm afraid that, as I said, I really can't possibly do this justice at all. But what I will try to do is, and this is a little bit the way I approached my topic, which was karma the last time I was here, which is to approach it synoptically. So we're not necessarily going to go into a great deal of depth on any particular practice or tradition, but I want to try to give you at least my sense, as somebody who studied the history of this tradition a fair amount, of where I see all this going. I want to start out, actually, by, I don't know how many of you are subscribers to the Shambhala Sun. I try to subscribe to all the Buddhist magazines I can, and the summer... actually, the September 2011 issue was called The Path of Love. And I wasn't quite sure what to make of this when it first arrived. And I won't go through, reading you the table of contents or anything, but what struck me about the issue as a whole is that it took the Western idea of love, I think particularly love in the sense of conjugal love or filial love or parental love or love of oneself as well, which is an integral part of this, and tried to bring Buddhist perspectives to the understandings that we already have as Westerners. And there's some marvelous articles in this, but it also struck me in thinking about it that there was a certain amount taken for granted that we know what we mean when we use this term. I think most of us who've lived long enough know the complexity of love and the variety of different reference that this term may have. And I chose the title that I did. It's a little glib, perhaps, but I think most of you probably caught the Beatles reference in there. And I picked, there's many popular songs I could have spun off of, but what I like about the Beatles' "All You Need Is Love" is the fact that the song itself, in the way it's constructed, evokes a variety of different types of love. Particularly in some, not necessarily so much in the lyrics, which are a little repetitive at times, but in the ways in which orchestration and other matters work in it, you may recall that it actually begins with da 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 dun 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 da da, right? Which is an evocation of a particular kind of love, perhaps. Patriotic love, if you will. And then in the sort of very end of the song, there are a variety of different voices and songs that come in. There's a brief quotation from Greensleeves, and there's She Loves You, yeah, yeah, yeah. So the Beatles song, simple as it is in a way, and almost simplistic in its message, actually evokes, or begins to evoke, the complexity of this term for us. I think if there's something I'm after here in this talk today, it's an attempt to both to underscore the complexity of the idea of love as we use that in Western cultural traditions, and the ways in which that is or is not easily translatable into Buddhist traditions as they developed in Asia. What you see in the Shambhala Sun is, of course, some kind of attempt to bring together the culturally derived notions of love that we have as Westerners with what one can make of Buddhism. So I'm sort of working at this slightly uneasy intersection and basically taking off on a word, the meaning of which I don't know, and I'm not sure any of us precisely knows. I do want to, before getting into the more obviously Buddhist material, just comment that love, and again I'll put scare quotes around it for the moment, is a notion that is widely celebrated and in and integral to many of the world's religions. There's actually an entire encyclopedia of love in world religions, if you care to check that out sometime. And the instances that I tend to think of when I use the word love, and I think about religious traditions, at least among traditions that I've studied in any depth at all, are actually Hindu and Islamic or Sufi examples. And those of you, I suspect it's no news to most of you that Hinduism has both a deeply devotional side to it and a whole literary and symbolic and imaginative and mythological tradition that, for instance, celebrates the love of Krishna for the milkmaids, the gopis, and that a great deal of the literature surrounding this is talked about both in terms of romantic love, as we might describe it, the pains of separation, and in frankly erotic terms often. Some of the greatest of Indian literature is erotic celebrations of Krishna's relationship with the gopis. And I think we have no difficulty calling the emotions that are evoked in these particular Hindu devotional traditions love, as we can at least distantly recognize it. And by the same token, especially in the Sufi traditions of Islam, the notion that God is the beloved and we are the lovers is a central motif, and a great deal of the best of Arabic and Urdu and other Muslim poetries is sort of fraught with the tension surrounding one's relationship to the divine as a beloved. Some of the great sort of stories of Islamic tradition, Layla and Manjun, for instance, are all about this, the madness of love, the frustrations of love, the brief consummations followed by, you know, painful agonies. So all of this is I think, understandable and recognizable to us. I think even, the Christian tradition is one that many of us may have grown up at least around, if not in. And clearly love is a notion that is central theologically and imaginatively and in other senses in the Christian tradition. The classic statement in 1 John 4:8, simply to the effect that God is love, is arguably as important a theological statement as you find anywhere in Christian tradition. And of course, anybody who has been to a Christian wedding or many other Christian occasions will know the passages from 1 Corinthians 13, where there's a discussion of faith, hope, and love, and of these, love is the greatest. So the celebration of love, both as the nature of God and as something that is vital between and among human beings, is close to the core of the way Christianity seems to have developed. This gets played out. I could do a whole course on some of these things, but a couple of the instances that for me have been most striking from Christian tradition. One comes at the very end of Dante's Paradiso. So this is in the 33rd canto, the very last canto of the entire Commedia, where he talks the very last four lines, where he has this vision of a kind of divine rose in which all the heavenly characters are arrayed, a mandala, if you will. And he says at the very end, "Here force failed my high fantasy, but my desire and will were moved already, like a wheel revolving uniformly, by the love that moves the sun and the other stars. L'amor che muove il sole e l'altre stelle." Unsurpassable Italian, this notion that love is the motive force behind the entire cosmos, again deeply interwoven with Christian traditions. You have a slightly different approach to this idea of love in the mystical poet, the Spanish mystical poet San Juan de la Cruz, Saint John of the Cross, as he's better known. And again, I won't pain you with my badly pronounced Spanish, so I'll simply give you the English translation of just the very first little stanza of this famous poem of his called Noche Oscura, Dark Night. On a dark secret night, starving for love and deep in flame, oh lucky flight, unseen I slipped away, my house at last was calm and safe. And it sort of goes on in this very elaborate romantic imagery, again almost sexual in some ways. And this is, of course, those of you who have some familiarity with Christian mysticism will know that love mysticism is deeply interwoven with it. And in that sense, the Hindu example, the Sufi example, the Christian examples, I think express love in ways, as I said before, that we can almost recognize. There are cultural differences, yes, but the language of romance, of separation and union, all this is deeply a part of this. In the Western tradition more generally, if we sort of go back to the Greeks, and this list is far from exhaustive, but there are different notions of love that have been discussed in Western culture, and three of the most common, again going back to Plato and Aristotle and others, are philia, eros, and agape, and each of these might roughly be translated as love in one or another context, and yet they have very different meanings. And this is part of, we can see that even at the roots of Western culture, the complexity of love is evident. And so, philia, as I think most of you would know, refers above all to friendship. Philadelphia, right, is the city of brotherly love or friendship. And eros is a more, it's where we get the word after all, a more erotic, a more sexualized kind of love. Agape has a range of different meanings, but it comes to mean a kind of charitable love, an expanded love, that goes beyond mere particular affiliations of one sort or another, and is of course agape, that in the Christian context is celebrated, and that's the Greek word in Corinthians. So again, I'm just sort of setting the stage a little bit culturally here in terms of the way in Western tradition and in some other religious traditions, love is quite recognizable as a theme. And it's easy within those traditions, I think, to make the translation from the sorts of love that we tend to experience throughout our lives and what's being depicted in religious texts, in religious images, in religious mythology. This then brings us finally to Buddhism, and I want to read at the risk of reading a longer passage than I perhaps should, but when I first read this passage very early in my days as a Buddhist, I think I was probably freshly in grad school at the time, a sort of paragraph from Edward Conze's Buddhism, Its Essence and Development, probably not a book that people read very much anymore, but he was quite an insightful scholar and practitioner. This is in a portion of this book in which he's actually talking about the ideal of the Bodhisattva, which is arguably a predominantly Mahayana ideal, but I think what he talks about here sets up a kind of tension that exists in Buddhism and may not exist in quite the same ways in the other traditions that I was citing. So I'll just bear with me as I read this for a moment. He says, the ideal of the Bodhisattva was partly due to social pressure on the order, but to a great extent, it was interest in the practice of the unlimited. This would be the immeasurables, right? The four immeasurables of love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, which had trained the monks not to discriminate between themselves and others. As we saw, Buddhism has at its disposal two methods by which it reduces the sense of separateness on the part of individuals. The one is the culture of social emotions or sentiments, such as friendliness and compassion. The other consists in acquiring the habit of regarding whatever one thinks, feels, or does as an interplay of impersonal forces called dharmas, weaning oneself slowly from such ideas as I or mine or self. There is a logical contradiction between the method of wisdom, which sees no persons at all, but only dharmas, and the method of the unlimited, which cultivates relations to people as persons. The meditation on dharmas dissolves other people as well as oneself into a conglomeration of impersonal and instantaneous dharmas. It reduces our manhood, sick, into five heaps or pieces plus a label. If there is nothing in the world except bundles of dharmas, as cold and impersonal and impersonal as atoms, instantaneously perishing all the time, there is nothing which friendliness and compassion could work on. One cannot wish well to a dharma which is gone by the time one has come to wish it well, nor can one pity a dharma, say a mind object or a sight organ or a sound consciousness. In those Buddhist circles where the method of dharmas was practiced to a greater extent than the unlimited, it led to a certain dryness of mind, to aloofness, and to lack of human warmth. The true task of the Buddhist is to carry on with both contradictory methods at the same time. As the method of dharmas leads to boundless contraction of the self, because everything is emptied out of it, so the method of the unlimited leads to a boundless expansion of the self, because one identifies oneself with more and more living beings. As the method of wisdom explodes the idea that there are any persons at all in the world, so the method of the unlimited increases the awareness of the personal problems of more and more persons. So I think an extraordinarily clear and incisive depiction of what, again, has always felt to me like an essential tension in the tradition, the tendency on the one hand to atomize everything, to break things down into impersonal dharmas, as he says, or dhammas, and yet on the other hand, there is this whole side of the tradition in which one does relate to other beings, as persons, and yet they don't necessarily always exist in clear and obvious harmony. I mean, as he says, the task is somehow to work with both of these. So with that as that kind of sets the tone for the kind of the central theme that I want to explore in working through and quite briefly a number of different Buddhist traditions. You can see that I can't possibly do justice to all that I have on here, but if we touch down here and there in this or that tradition, we may get a feeling, I hope, for how this kind of tension, contradiction strikes me as a strong term, but at least this tension that Kanza describes has played itself out over the course of Buddhist traditions. In the Theravada tradition, which I suspect is the one that most of you are most familiar with if you're longtime practitioners of mindfulness meditation, if you work back into the original Pali texts that are, of course, at the root of the Theravada tradition or traditions, you find that there is a, just as in the West we had, you know, philia, eros, agape, and other words as well that refer to different aspects of love. You have in the Theravada tradition, and I think this goes for Buddhism as a whole probably, since the Theravada tradition is really foundational to, at least in one form or another, to so much of the rest of Buddhist tradition. But you find what I would describe not so much as a lexicon of different forms of love, but certainly a lexicon of desire. And the words that I've given here are only the tip of the iceberg. I was digging through my Pali dictionary this morning, and it just went on and on and on. You know, if allegedly Inuits have 50 different words for snow, then Buddhism has 50 different words for desire. And most of them are to be regarded negatively. So terms like raga and lobha, commonly refer to various kinds of desire. Kama, which is actually the name of the god of love in Hindu traditions, and therefore is personified as sexual love. Rati, which is an even more passionate and powerful form of sexual love. Tanha, which is craving, and is of course in the Buddha's first teaching, given as the actual explanation for the origin of suffering. It's tanha, it's craving or thirst. So you have all these words that indicate desire, and desire is at least in the foundational teachings regarded as one of the key forces that keeps the wheel of samsara going, and therefore desire and the various forms that can take, which might include then what we call love, needs perhaps to be transcended. These are all arguable points, of course, but I do want to stress the frequency with which these terms occur. And this is not to say that there are not terms that mean something like desire that aren't considered positive. And there are at least two that are quite important in the kind of psychology of Theravada Buddhism. One of these is chanda, which is the sort of positive aspiration for something. So this is the term I have to invoke any time, as they do every term. Students ask me, well, if desire is the cause of further suffering in samsara, then isn't the desire for nirvana also a desire, and don't you have to overcome that, and don't we have a terrible paradox? And I have to point out that there are different terminological issues, and Buddhism does have a term for, in effect, positive desire. So when you aspire to nirvana, a typical term will be something like chanda. It will not be raga or kama or any of these. So there's a very fine psychological distinction that's made there. Chanda is sort of, you know, positive aspiration in a general sense. The key term, though, and of course the term that appears in my title is metta. And this is the term that has bedeviled translators, I think it's fair to say, ever since the Pali Canon first was translated into English. I've seen any number of different versions of this. Sometimes it's simply translated as love. though I would argue that that brings so much cultural baggage for most of us that it probably is best avoided. Loving kindness is a translation that I've seen a fair amount as well. Probably a more accurate translation, if you're simply rooting it in the language itself, is something more like philia, something more like friendliness. And in fact, I think that's the term that Rupert Geffen uses in his wonderful new selection from the Pali Canon, Sayings of the Buddha. We can argue long and hard about what the appropriate translation is, but it's clear that metta is a virtue within the both the early traditions of Buddhism and in later traditions, because as someone who studied Tibetan Buddhism more than any other type, I'm constantly encountering meditations on, or at least prayers related to, the four immeasurables, of which metta, or love, loving kindness, friendliness, is the first. So it's a deeply important term in Buddhist tradition. But the question is it love in precisely our range of senses of the term? And if you think, for instance, about the kind of locus classicus for the whole idea of metta is what's called the Metta Sutta. So many of you will have read this. Some of you might have even memorized it. It's frequently chanted in the tradition. And it's short enough that I can read it to you, because, again, as with Kanza's quote, I think it's important enough to have it out there. He who is skilled in welfare, who wishes to attain that calm state, nibbana, should act thus. He should be able, upright, perfectly upright, of noble speech, gentle and humble, contented, easily supported, with few desires, of light livelihood, with senses calmed, discreet, not impudent, not greedily attached to families. He should not pursue the slightest thing for which otherwise men might censure him. May all beings be happy and secure. May their hearts be wholesome. Whatever living beings there be, feeble or strong, tall, stout or medium, short, small or large, without exception, seen or unseen, those dwelling far or near, those who are born or those who are to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, nor despise any person whatsoever in any place. Let him not wish any harm to another out of anger or ill will. Just as a mother would protect her only child at the risk of her own life, even so let him cultivate a boundless heart towards all beings. Let his thoughts of boundless love pervade the whole world, above, below, and across, without any obstruction, without any hatred, without any enmity. Whether he stands, walks, sits, or lies down, as long as he is awake, he should develop this mindfulness. This, they say, is the noblest living here. Not falling into wrong views, being virtuous and endowed with insight, by discarding attachment to sense desires, never again is he reborn. So a couple of interesting things to note about one could spend a lot of time going through this. But you see, for one thing, the kind of seeds of the sort of metta meditation that I suspect all of you have practiced here. The idea that one takes a feeling of benevolence and sends it to all the four quarters of the ten directions. But a notion as well, and this is key in the very last line, that the purpose of this practice is to discard attachment to sense desires. So if this is love in some form, it's a love that somehow does not involve attachment of the sort that most of us live with day in, day out, a good part of the day. So this problem of having a kind of universal benevolence that's without attachment is I think keyed in to that quotation I read from Kanza earlier. Metta on its own is expressed in passages like this, and of course, as you all know, and as I've already mentioned, it also is part of a system of four stations of Brahma, or sublime states, or immeasurable states of mind. that are to be cultivated by the meditator. And again, as noted before, and as all of you know, these are, we'll say, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And it's in discussions of these four states that you come up with some interesting and rather precise definitions, maybe not in the original suttas, but certainly in the commentarial literature that follows on them. And in that sense, loving kindness, metta, is seen above all as being the desire, in the positive sense of that term, for beings to be happy, and presumably for all beings to be happy. Compassion, which there's a whole set of terms revolving around compassion too, which I won't discuss, but what generally is translated as compassion is the desire for all beings to be free from suffering. So you have a kind of complementarity there. Sympathetic joy, as one can tell from the term itself, is the rejoicing in the happiness and the good of others. And all of these are, you know, again, what Kanza might refer to as sort of social emotions, right? That we strive to develop in relation to other people, but as a kind of, not exactly a damper to this, but as a counterforce, but as an important and crucial addendum, just like at the end of the Metta Sutta, there is the fourth immeasurable, which is equanimity. Which is not being attached to one side or the other, one person or the other. And so it kind of, you know, if just love, compassion, and sympathetic joy might, you know, sort of push us out into the temptation towards attachment, equanimity will even that out. And that equanimity, again, is based partly in these wisdom traditions that Kanza is talking about, in which we recognize that there is no distinct self to begin with, and that attachment to self, whether it's ourself or other selves, is the source of our suffering and samsara, and so has to be overcome. So again, within the four immeasurables themselves, you see something of a tension, I think. You might think of it too as a kind of oscillation that's necessary. You sort of go outward, you pull back, or you break things down, you build them up. Both of these are involved in meditative traditions as far back as we can see. I won't comment a lot on the Abhidhamma. The point I wanted to make about Abhidhamma, when I was reviewing the sort of list of different mental factors that are in the Theravada version of the Abhidhamma, it's interesting to note that among the positive mental factors, because these factors are generally divided into, you know, sort of powerfully negative, secondarily negative, very positive, fairly positive, that the positive mental factors don't anywhere include anything like love or friendliness or so forth. So something like metta doesn't find its way into this classic list of the fundamental constituents of the universe, the dhammas or dharmas that Kanza was talking about here, which again is not to by any means to diminish its importance to the tradition right from the beginning. It clearly is there. You run into it again and again in different texts. But it is interesting that in actually breaking things down, the authors of the Abhidhamma did not choose to sort of put something like metta at the forefront. There's a whole other side that you tend to run into in Theravada countries if you actually visit them, something more of a popular tradition, which often is based less in the suttas, let alone in the Abhidhamma, which is really very difficult, but more based in, for instance, the Jataka stories, the stories of the Buddha's previous lives, which are used in popular preaching, in artistic depictions, and in various other contexts to impart basic moral laws, basic virtues to people. And I want to just briefly mention what is arguably the most popular of these, and this is the Vesantara Jataka. It's probably the longest of the Jatakas, and it, according to Theravada tradition, Vesantara was the form that the Buddha took before his final life as Siddhartha Gautama, or Gautama. And the story of Vesantara is basically one of extravagant generosity. Vesantara is a prince of a kingdom who, to make a very long story quite short, gives everything away. He gives away his precious elephant. He gives away all his jewels. And when it's demanded of him by a rather greedy Brahmin, there's some social commentary here perhaps, that he give up his children, he gives them his children. And eventually he's basically willing to give up everything. And it's this, you know, whether this notion, we talk about the relation often between love and sacrifice or self-sacrifice, and Vesantara is willing to give absolutely everything away. He's willing to give himself away, in effect. And at the end, in a kind of, you can't say deus ex machina in a Buddhist context because there's no deus, but in perhaps a karmic resolution that defies belief, somehow at the end everything is restored to him. It's not quite like Job either, but it's an interesting move. And this spirit of generosity is, I think, linked in Theravada ways of thinking, maybe not directly, but indirectly, with notions of, for instance, loving kindness and metta. This is perhaps a more active form of it. And generosity is, of course, a very important virtue through all Buddhist traditions, not only for the reason that generosity to the Sangha helps to maintain the Sangha as an institution, but because, at least in principle, the development of a generous heart and a willingness to give and to give some more is fundamental to one's eventual attainment of higher rebirths and someday nirvana. So I just raised this notion of self-sacrifice as a sacrifice of goods and of other things as a kind of allied notion that's connected to love. So one could say obviously much more about Theravada traditions, but you know, whither love in this? I'm not sure that we have. We certainly have this notion of a kind of universal benevolence in metta, and then connected specifically to meditations on the four immeasurables, which are connected with the desire that others be happy and that others be freed from suffering. And we appreciate the happiness and the good that belong to others. But whether that comes close to love in the variety of different ways we have tended to mean it in the West, I'm not so sure. I think one of the things to be said about all this is that I think a Buddhist contribution in all this is to help us, it holds up a mirror to us in a way and makes us think about what we mean by a term like love when we see that the somewhat similar emotions or attitudes don't take quite the same form in a different cultural setting. I think that probably most people would say that, well, if in Theravada tradition it's a little tricky to define something like love, then in Mahayana maybe it's not so much of a problem. Mahayana, of course, is famous for the Bodhisattva ideal and for the notion that one ought to take as many lives as one possibly can, or be born as many times as one possibly can in order to help an infinite number of beings. And certainly there is, I think it's fair to say that simply in the discourse of Mahayana, a great deal more attention is paid, overtly at least, to loving kindness and compassion and a variety of these, quote, social emotions that Kanza was referring to earlier. I'm going to argue, however, that some of the same tensions that Kanza identified and that we saw to some degree in the Theravada are actually there in the Mahayana as well. There are a number of ways in which you can come at this. One of my favorites, because it was I did most of my graduate work on this, is Dharmakirti, the famous 7th century philosopher's argument for the fact that the Buddha was enlightened. He does this in the second chapter of his text, the Pramanavartaka, which is if there's a philosophy of religion in Buddhism, it's found in this chapter of that text. Dharmakirti argues that you can actually prove the Buddha's enlightenment. This is a rather strong claim, but logicians were confident in those days. And Dharmakirti basically says, we know that the Buddha attained enlightenment because of his compassion. So compassion actually becomes a kind of logical reason for it. Dharmakirti does not, however, leave it at that, nor does he simply stop at that assertion. He goes through then a very, very complex set of arguments that end up in an extended analysis of the mind-body problem, because he realizes that if the claims that Buddhists make, after all, for the Buddha's compassion, are that he has developed compassion to the nth degree, and Dharmakirti immediately realizes that within the course of one human life, few to no people will be able to develop compassion to the nth degree. So he has to demonstrate that there are other lives, past and future. And so he gets into a whole discussion of the mind-body problem, refutes the materialists, proves that mind and body are separate, and it sort of goes from there. Anyway, so it's not necessarily a feel-good kind of thing. It's rigorous logical analysis. So this is one way in which you can come at this. I mentioned the Bodhisattva ideal already, and here I just want to cite quickly two kind of classic exemplars of this. The Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, who of course is known by many names in different Buddhist cultures, Chenrezig in Tibet, Guanyin in China, Kanon in Japan, and at least one of the classic stories about Avalokiteshvara, this helps to explain the thousand-armed, 11-headed version that I suspect many of you have seen images of, is that Avalokiteshvara had vowed, you know, to save all sentient beings, you know, out of his immense loving kindness, his immense compassion. But on the realization that sentient beings were literally numberless, he realized that there was a problem there, and that for every sentient being he saved, there was still going to be, you know, no matter how many he saved, there were always going to be more that he hadn't saved. And at this point, he in a sense, he kind of exploded, and he was put back together by Amitabha, his sort of Buddha figure, and was given the thousand arms, thousand hands, each of which has an eye in the center, and his heads were restored with as 11 different heads, and he continues to work even if in some sense it's a paradoxical and impossible attempt to liberate numberless beings, as of course the famous Zen saying has it. Another example, probably no less mythological in a certain sense than Avalokiteshvara, is Vimalakirti, who is a layman of the town of Vaishali, supposedly during the Buddha's time. And the Vimalakirti Nirdesha Sutra, or the holy teaching of Vimalakirti in Bob Thurman's translation of it, has an extended and I think very interesting passage on, and again, he's using the term love for Maitri, that's the Sanskrit for metta here. He talks about the love that a bodhisattva has. Says he generates the love that is firm, its high resolve unbreakable, like a diamond, the love that is pure, purified in its intrinsic nature, the love that is even, its aspirations being equal, the saint's love that has eliminated its enemy, the bodhisattva's love that continuously develops living beings, the Tathagata's love that understands reality, the Buddha's love that causes living beings to awaken from their sleep, the love that is spontaneous because it is fully and enlightened spontaneously, the love that is enlightenment because it is unity of experience, the love that has no presumption because it has eliminated attachment and aversion. It sort of goes on from there. It's a long passage, and I won't read all of it to you. But what happens in subsequently in this passage is that having sort of exalted this great love that the Bodhisattva has for sentient beings, Vimalakirti then sort of deconstructs it and says it's all empty. and it issues in a number of different paradoxes, which again I will spare you for the moment. But you see, particularly in a sutra like Vimalakirti, which is I would say with the Lotus Sutra, one of the two absolutely classic central Mahayana sutras, you see this very same kind of tension that Kanza was referring to before, between the great love that the Bodhisattva has, the great compassion that the Bodhisattva has, and the tendency then to immediately deconstruct the very idea of love, the very idea of compassion, the very idea of a sentient being. There were Mahayana philosophers and contemplatives who attempted to make some sense of this paradox or tension or contradiction. And one of the most astute and certainly poetic of them was Shantideva, whose Way of the Bodhisattva I would commend to all of you. I think many of you have probably read it. Interestingly, his discussion of this is in his chapter on what they call here meditative concentration. And he has a number of different ways in which he tries to overcome this paradox or this tension or this contradiction. The most central, perhaps, is to argue that two points, really. One is that we ought to love all beings for the simple reason that we are all in effect part of the same body. Buddhists don't often actually make the argument that all things are one. That's in spite of hot dog jokes and things like that, it would not be a Buddhist who would probably say make me one with everything. Shantideva actually does come close to this, though, in arguing that just as if your foot is hurt, you will try to attend to it, so other beings are, in effect, part of one great body, and that they ought to be loved just as much as you would love a part of your own body. Shantideva is not explicit that this is because beings are interconnected, but that is a notion that you, of course, can pick up from that, and that's a notion that is more explicit in something like the Avatamsaka or Hua Yen Sutra, which gives birth to a whole very important philosophical tradition in East Asian Buddhism. But Shantideva also recognizes that although we ought to love these beings as much as we love a part of our, or care for these beings as much as we care about a part of our own body, that on the other hand, there are no beings. And he works his way, one of the ways he tries to work out of the apparent contradiction is to say that, well, in effect, there are no suffering beings, but there is suffering. Even if there are no beings that we can specifically pinpoint in the end, we can at least conventionally say there is suffering, and suffering ought to be eliminated. Anyway, he's got a number of different tacks that he takes in this chapter, and whether they're entirely persuasive is a separate question. But he takes seriously the tension that's built in to the idea that we ought to love and be compassionate towards all beings, and yet there are no beings. In terms of sort of meditative praxis, and Shantideva is one of the great contributors to this, along with many other figures from Indian and then Tibetan and other Buddhist traditions. In Tibetan tradition, these are referred to as mind training traditions, but they have their roots in Indian authors like Shantideva, Asanga, and others. And here there's a kind of sequence that begins to develop, and I'm not going to go into it in great detail. You can find this from almost any basic book on Tibetan Buddhism, but there's a kind of the ideal of the Bodhisattva is to attain the state known as, or the mind known as bodhicitta, right? The thought of awakening, altruistic aspiration to enlightenment. There's many ways this term has been translated, and that's kind of the essence of being a bodhisattva, is to have the bodhicitta, the mind of awakening. But the mind of awakening, you only become a bodhisattva at the point where you spontaneously and naturally and perpetually desire to work for the benefit of all sentient beings. And that, in turn, is only developed if before that you have developed compassion, and not just ordinary compassion, but great compassion, says the Mahayana. That is not only the desire that all beings be freed from suffering, but that you yourself take responsibility for freeing them. And great compassion can only be developed on the basis of great love or friendliness or loving kindness. Again, the idea, not just the wish that all beings should attain happiness, but that you yourself take responsibility for that. And so it's this sequence that is at the root of many of the meditations along the lines of love and compassion that you see in Indian traditions, and these are picked up in particular, often with only slight variations, in the Tibetan traditions. They are, again, though just like with the four immeasurables, they're balanced by meditations that emphasize, for instance, equanimity. And here you'll often find visualizations, for instance, of a friend, enemy, stranger in front of you, and you go through various exercises in which you even out your instinctive emotional reactions to these different sorts of beings. So there's always, you know, there's again the building up, the breaking down, the expansion, the contraction, the social emotion, and then the rigorous atomistic analysis. It's all working in tandem, at least in an ideal sense. Because I invoke the notion of self-sacrifice in the Theravada tradition, I'll mention just briefly an example in Mahayana tradition. I don't think this story appears in the Pali Jatakas. Very, very famous story about a prince in, I think the actual pilgrimage site is in Nepal, where a prince who's out with his companions one day comes across a starving tigress who has a number of different cubs. And he decides, because of his great love, to sacrifice himself to her. He simply gives up his body to this tigress. You know, this is a notion of sacrifice, if anything, that goes even farther than the sort of sacrifice that Vesantara exercised in that famous Pali Jataka. The point in all this, I think, is that for Mahayana traditions, they're really explicit about this, even though I think this is implicit in Theravada as well, that if you're actually going to attain enlightenment or awakening or become a Buddha, which is in fact the goal in Mahayana, you have to balance wisdom and compassionate means or methods. You have to have both. So in that sense, precisely what Kanza was talking about at the beginning, this necessity to have both the rigorous emptying analysis and the social emotions works its way into the schemes that define the Mahayana path. And in fact, Mahayana Buddhahood is usually defined, at least in one scheme, as twofold, a form body and a dharma body, or form bodies really, and a dharma body. And the form body is said to be the result of these various methods, which are driven by love and compassion and bodhicitta. The dharma body is the result of the kind of rigorous emptying analysis. So you've got to have both, and they've got to sort of work in tandem, at least in the well-led life. I'm going to pass, in the interest of time, and hoping to have some discussion, I'm going to pass more quickly over the last couple, the fourth and fifth sections here. Just to point out, I guess, that we find a great variety in all of these, in Zen and Pure Land traditions, which are arguably the primary traditions of East Asian Buddhism, that is the Buddhism of Japan, Korea, China, and Vietnam. There's a number of different ways all this spins. So for me, one of the most perplexing of the koans, and I've been reading koans since I was about 14, still haven't made much sense of any of them, but for me, the one, which I guess is appropriate, the one that always has bugged me the most, and the one time I actually had an encounter with a Zen master, I argued with him about this, which really showed I knew nothing. But anyway, is the famous koan of the cat. Does anybody know this one? You want to remember it? Yeah, okay, anyway. I forgot the, I think Joshu is the monk. No, it's Nanchuan, is the monk who one morning when his best disciple, Joshu, and I'm mixing Chinese and Japanese terms, my apologies, when his best disciple is out for the day somewhere, he holds a cat by the scruff of its neck and holds it up in front of the assembly and says, if anybody can say a word to save this cat, they'd better do so. Nobody says anything and he kills the cat. His disciple comes back later in the day and Nanchuan relates this story to him in the hall there, and his disciple puts his sandals on his head and walks out of the hall. At which point, Nanchuan says, well, if you'd been here, you could have saved the cat. I keep worrying about the cat, and that perhaps is my problem. It's not about the cat. But my point in this is that Zen has sometimes, I think, been perceived because of the modes of training that are often involved and because of the rhetoric of so many of its stories as being really hard-assed. And I think people don't always think that compassion is so much a part of Zen as it is in these other traditions that I've been talking about. And I don't think that's the case at all, but I think that the expressions of it in Zen are quite different. There's a kind of related story, an actual historical event that I think points this up. And this is the so-called Samye debate. This was a debate that occurred in the late 8th century in Tibet, and it was a complex affair. It probably lasted several years. But essentially, the king was trying to decide which sort of Buddhism to follow, whether the Indian style or the Chinese style. And the Chinese style was represented by a Chan or Zen Buddhist teacher. The Indians were represented by a number of sort of great pundits who were skilled at logical argumentation. And the debate turned on the question of whether the path to enlightenment on the path to enlightenment, one ought to sort of build up gradually from virtuous practices through contemplative skills, eventually then to attaining direct insight into the nature of reality, or whether you went straight for the nature of reality. And that, as you might expect, was the Zen approach. And in Zen rhetoric, there often is, as there sometimes was in Mahayana sutras, an apparent demeaning of social emotions and even some of the traditional virtues from the standpoint of ultimate truth, right? So the Chan master at this debate was depicted by his Indian opponents as not caring about love, compassion, bodhicitta, or anything like this, and therefore no king in his right mind would establish a kingdom where the virtues weren't respected. Well, apart from the fact that there were three languages involved, and apart from the fact that the king may or may not have ever come to a clear decision, I think the depiction of the Chan Zen master there was unfair in a way, because there is a notion at work in Chan traditions, and you see this in parallel in certain Tibetan traditions as well, for instance, Dzogchen and Mahamudra, that compassion and love and, if you will, the social emotions can be a natural and spontaneous outflow of the attainment of a state of wisdom, or an insight into the nature of reality. So again, tricky matters here when it comes to Zen. I have to read you at least one poem by EQ just to show you that that sex has not been left behind entirely. I'm sure many of you are aware, there's a whole kind of subtext running through Buddhism of celebrations of sexuality. EQ was a great Zen master. He rose to be the abbot of Daitokuji, one of the most important monasteries in Kyoto. And he wrote a lot of poems about sex. I'll just read you two very quick ones here. I'll spare you some of the really graphic ones, but Rinzai's disciples never got the Zen message, but I, the blind donkey, know the truth. Love play can make you immortal. The autumn breeze of a single night of love is better than 100,000 years of sterile sitting meditation. Stilted koans and convoluted answers are all monks have, pandering endlessly to officials and rich patrons. Good friends of the Dharma, so proud, let me tell you, a brothel girl in gold brocade is worth more than any of you. You get the idea. And you know, people don't know quite what to make of this, right? This is somebody who is a respected abbot. He writes standard Zen poems, too, of the sort that you could see almost anywhere. And yet he had this side of his life that was completely involved in the erotic. This too is a side of Zen. Of course, those of you who studied a little bit about Zen know that it's Zen monks are famous for sort of going over the monastery wall at night. And they would not be the only monks in Buddhist traditions who have done that, let me add, in the interests of fairness. Another way of thinking about love is in the Pure Land tradition, which is the other sort of great tradition of East Asian Buddhism. And here I'm using the word love for the attitude that Amida Buddha, or Amitabha Buddha, has towards sentient beings, based on his vow when he was a bodhisattva that, and this is a little convoluted, but this is the way the rhetoric of these things works, if when he became a fully enlightened Buddha, all beings could not be born in his Pure Land simply by reciting, remembering his name, then let him not become a fully enlightened Buddha. Well, of course, he is a fully enlightened Buddha, which means it guarantees that vow is true, and that all we have to do is think of or recite the name of Amida Buddha, and we will be born in his Pure Land. And this is engendered, I mean, again, this is another sort of side of love. This is devotion, if you will. Not that there isn't devotion in these other traditions. There's plenty of it, but it's in at the forefront and really explicit in Pure Land traditions. And whether we would consider this a form of love, both by Amida towards us and us towards Amida, is at least open to question. I'll leave aside the notion of self-surrender. The only point I was going to make here was very quickly was that in both the Zen tradition and the Pure Land tradition, there is a sense in which you have to give up yourself. It may not be in the form of Vesantara's infinite generosity. It may not be in the form of the prince's sacrifice of his body to the tigress. But in both the so-called other-powered and self-powered traditions, self is something that has to be overcome. And in this sense, this is another meaning of self-sacrifice. And, you know, when you've emptied yourself entirely, presumably you're open to everything and everyone that is out there. And whether you take a Zen approach, or some have argued that whether you take a Zen approach or a Pure Land approach, different as they seem, the process may end up at the same point. Vajra, I honestly got it. I left no time for the stuff I've actually studied. let me very quickly just a few points here. There is, as many of you are aware, a very powerful element of, we're just talking about devotion to Amida and by Amida, but guru devotion and devotion to and service to the deity in tantric traditions or Vajrayana traditions are terrifically important. And if you read the poetry of a great Tibetan saint like Milarepa, the attitude, the feelings that he evokes for his lama, Marpa, are I think clearly love of the filial sort, and I think easily match up with our at least one of our ideas of that word, and similarly the deity, particularly if one has a sort of main meditation deity, the relationship one develops with that deity is not only one of service but a kind of mutual affection. That's quite powerful. And of course, that kind of devotion is found in all Buddhist traditions, including Theravada, to a much more significant degree than texts like this will ever let on. One of the most important practices in Vajrayana or Tantra traditions generally goes under the name of sadhana. And in this, the key to sadhana is visualizing yourself in the form of a deity, a Buddha/deity. And an important part of the sadhana is to, for instance, when reciting mantras, to send out waves of light, healing, enlightening, purifying light to all beings. And so there's a kind of a dramatic, imaginative enactment of love and compassion and other social emotions. Though at the same time, there also are emptying processes that go on in the course of a sadhana too. So a sadhana combines these basic tendencies as well. There is, of course, tantric Buddhism is most notorious and, alas, perhaps best known for having brought an explicitly erotic set of images and symbols and perhaps practices to at least certain elements of the tradition. I'll just make a couple of points quickly here. One is that whatever you read about tantric sex, probably don't believe most of it. And B, that in many, if not all, cases, what is described as tantric sex is so little like sex as we tend to experience it that it hardly merits the name. I'll leave that at that. And this is not only this is on the basis of reading, mind you. Let me be clear about that. And there is this tension in tradition because especially Tibetan Buddhism is rooted in these Indian traditions, particularly late Indian traditions, which were dominated by Tantra. And so you have this whole set of, virtuous practices, the four immeasurables, the six perfections, and so forth. But you also have these other elements and other practices. Where they came from is difficult to say. Historians are still debating it fiercely. But there is a more explicit imagery surrounding sex in Tantra than in any other Buddhist traditions, and so that particular form of love, if you will, is played out. But again, whether love, when we think of sexual love in terms of our loved ones, or our partners, or spouses, or whatever they may be, it's both love and sex are I think oddly inappropriate terms, at least when what you read a bit into the literature of this, and that's why it's because on the one hand, you can say, oh well, sex is the path to enlightenment, great, sign me up. On the other hand, tantric sex is all about a perfect relationship, probably not that either. A much debated book is Miranda Shaw's Passionate Enlightenment, which does some superb historical research, but also gets into the realm of arguing that the relationship between partners in tantric sexual yoga, and there is certainly such a thing, is a kind of model for how relationships ought to be. And Others have said this is probably not the case, that we shouldn't read too much, we shouldn't assume too much of that the solutions to our particular relationship problems will be found in an 8th century Indian text or a 14th century Tibetan practice or whatever it may be. I love to invoke, at least in passing, Chogyam Trungpa's railing against the idea of idiot compassion, because compassion is deeply important in Tibetan Buddhism or Vajrayana Buddhism, just as it is in Mahayana. But the idea that we must, our compassion has to be wise and not simply kind of blubbery oh, I feel so badly for X, Y, and Z. Of course, we instinctively feel that, but what good does that do? And I think Trungpa was simply trying to argue, again, this is becoming a familiar theme by now, was trying to argue for compassion that is guided by a kind of sharp intelligence and wisdom, and that doesn't get caught up in its own emotions. That, after all, to go back to, you know, those Pali terms, ends up being forms of attachment. And somehow we have to care, we have to love, we have to be compassionate without being attached. I mean, this to me is a bigger koan than the cat, even. Last point on Vajrayana, and then I'll wrap it up. This ties back in a way to the comments I made before about the Samye debate. I mentioned before that traditions of practice, meditation, especially like Dzogchen or the Great Perfection and Mahamudra, the Great Seal, don't always work. They certainly involve compassion and loving kindness and so forth in their practices, but they don't, as with Zen, they don't necessarily come at it in that gradual way. In some versions, yes. In other versions, the key thing is to realize the nature of your own mind, and a direct and true realization of the nature of your own mind will lead naturally to a kind of bliss, which itself overflows into a compassion for all beings. So, in a way, there are two ways you can imagine the relation between wisdom and the social emotions. One is that you develop the social emotions first, and then, only then, do you become really ready for wisdom. The other is that you go straight to wisdom, and the social emotions, love, compassion, and so forth, are natural outflows of that. There's been a great deal of debate over the years among Buddhists about these kinds of things, and as I've commented before, I think, you know, most Buddhists, in fact, try to balance these. I think I'm going to leave it at that. I think the most of the points that I would have made in conclusion have come along the way, and I hope, if nothing else, I've shown you, A, that the notions of love we have are rooted in our own particular cultural circumstances, and that making the translation over into Buddhist terms is a difficult matter, and that within Buddhism, and then secondly, that within Buddhism itself, the cultivation of emotions and attitudes like love and compassion they're not problematic exactly, but they do exist in a kind of complex and interesting tension with the whole wisdom side of the tradition, and that a great deal of what Buddhists over 2,500 years, and certainly I suspect many of the people in this room, have been dealing with is trying somehow to maintain that balance that Kanza referred to in the long quotation I read at the beginning. So I will leave it at that. I hope there's a little time for questions. I apologize for going on, but I'm an academic, and I'm true to my nature. Yeah.
I'm curious why you wouldn't translate metta as agape, and what you see as the difference between those two, because it always seems to me that that's sort of what you're shooting for. Yes, it's sort of friendliness and well-wishing, but that you're sort of working towards sort of a more transcendent sort of.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's reasonable. Again, agape, when I started digging around what little I could do, it seemed to be a very complicated term, and of course it ends because of Paul's usage of it in Corinthians and elsewhere. It ends up having Christian connotations, and that's why that's my only hesitation, I think. But I think I completely agree with you that the sense of an expanded love is central to both of those, and in that sense I would agree.
Well, you made me think of the debate that happened when Buddhism came to China. You have this Confucian culture that so emphasized relationships, most of which were familial, or part, husband, wife, and parents and children. And there was this criticism that here's this tradition that is advocating, celibacy and leaving for a monastery. How can you honor these relationships? And it seemed to me there's this tension that one attempt to solve it was, if I go out and practice and work on myself, then I become even more capable of, helping the people I care about, like the Miao Shan story, right? Or you have this larger sense of love that we're all being reborn numerous times. We're all each other's parents and children, right. And therefore the practice will help me expand it out. So it seems like there's like a cultivationist aspect and then a metaphysical side to come in and try to respond to that. So I was wondering if you see the tension you're talking about is playing out in that, if there's an application to our lives, like I'm here listening to you and not with my wife. And so, you might say Roger's words are making me a better husband in some way, and therefore I justify that in our practice in a sense. That's what the Chinese Buddhists are arguing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think you have to separate out the fact that for most Buddhist literature, let's put it this way, in most times and places, was produced by monks for monks. And therefore, family was presumably something that was to be left behind. Spouses were not an issue, and so forth. So a great deal of this simply doesn't take that kind of thing into account. Yes, of course you can find the famous Sigala Sutta of the Pali Canon is advice to lay people, and there are such discussions, but mostly they're just they're essentially not interested in that. And in that sense, the Confucian critics in China were actually right about the way the tradition's discourse and rhetoric tended to run. That said, there always have been Buddhist lay people. We wouldn't have had support for the monasteries if there hadn't been. And I would probably go along the lines you were suggesting, or at least saying that the Chinese tended to go, which is that we presumably by enriching your own spiritual life, enhancing your own wisdom, even by going on retreat sometimes, this will have a better overall effect socially than if you simply were embroiled in samsara.
So part of the leading is what an infant son behind was brought up a number of times as how do you love people?
Yeah. Love them, yeah, right, exactly. And of course, it all plays out nicely in the end, but at the moment, it seemed, as my students say, harsh. Yeah. I mean, that's you've asked such a huge question, and that's an inadequate answer. But I think what you've suggested is really one of the best routes to making sense of all of this. Yeah.
Could you just talk a little bit about the point here,
on love? Yeah. Only. I mean, the point here only, and I suppose the example of the prince who sacrificed himself to the tigress would be one example of that. Remember when you perform a metta meditation, it's not just human beings, even though they may be the easiest to visualize, and you sometimes run into people etc. But the notion is that, after all sentient beings, sooner or later, will achieve some form of enlightenment, whatever you call it. And in that sense, there is, whether the cutoff point is at plants or not has been debated, but certainly sentient beings, as they're usually defined, include the whole range of creatures. Again, that's a theological term you can't really use appropriately in Buddhism. But they too should be subject to it. And, you know, it goes back to a point that Mark made too, that after all, given the truth of rebirth, we all have been all possible forms. And we've lived many lives as animals, as humans, in this place or that place. And so, it's all part of a larger cycle. And all these beings are deserving, by virtue of being suffering sentient beings, they are deserving of our love and compassion and our work for them. I'm taking a Mahayana point of view here, and are working for them so that they eventually can achieve enlightenment. So, beyond that, you can get into interesting debates about whether Buddhism is actually speciesist or not, and I'll stay away from that for the moment and leave it with that.
Excuse me, could you define attachment in the Buddhist sense? I know in American psychology, attachment is sometimes defined as a psychological problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a personal point.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if what the Buddhists are talking about when they see attachment as the source of all suffering.
Yeah. I can't give you a precise scholastic definition off the top of my head. Maybe Court could give one. But anyway, I would say that attachment has to do with it's complicated because it's related to our belief and actually rooted in our belief that some object, whether that object be a person or a thing or an ideal or a country or whatever it may be, that there is some kind of intrinsic existence to it, that it has a real self, as Buddhists would say, and it's rooted, I think, in the Buddhist. So that's the sort of metaphysical or ontological side of it. From the psychological standpoint, I think that believing that things have selves, or we have selves, or you have a self, and yet things change, right? There is impermanence. And so we try to hold on to our own identity, or to what we think another person is, or to some object we may have, and none of it's going to stand still. So in that sense, I think the attachment is related to this metaphysical mistake we make in thinking that there's something permanent anywhere in samsara, and to our profound dissatisfaction and unhappiness when things, even though we try to fix things, they won't be fixed. They won't stay the same. So it's in that sense, I suppose, it's the attempt to hold on to something that both isn't there, and to the degree that it's there is inevitably going to change anyway.
Is that somehow similar to idolatry?
Oh yeah. You could certainly argue it in those terms. Yeah, and that's some people, I've occasionally seen people talk about Islam, for instance, obviously with its strong rejection of idolatry. In similar terms, because in Islamic terms, the only unchanging reality is God, and to hold on to anything that is not God is a form of idolatry. Now, of course, the God problem with Buddhism limits the applicability of that comparison.
They worship money sometimes.
The what? Oh yeah, yeah. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, money, nation, whatever. You name it, you can be attached to it, almost literally. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I have a more practical question. I believe you're connected with the Tibetan monastery in Arcus, Minneapolis,
mm-hmm.
and the Tibetan community there.
Mm-hmm.
So, with all these people in exile, do you think that there's been more of an emphasis on metta than perhaps if they were still living in Tibet, or is it a different type of emphasis of a way of dealing?
It's certainly a way of dealing, and I think particularly when you read or hear the accounts of, say, Tibetan monks who were imprisoned for many years in China, who in a way kept themselves going through meditations on compassion. You could argue that maybe in these extreme circumstances it might have taken on greater importance, but I think that these meditations have been part of the tradition. You know, everybody's got problems everywhere all the time, and presumably these sorts of meditations can help, help in one way or another, both in extreme circumstances like the ones that refugees and people in prison have faced, and people who have more everyday kinds of problems. You know more people in the Tibetan community than I do.
I would agree. I think, historically, these practices have been so integral to the tradition that, it might be manifesting a slightly different way, but I think it's pretty core to the tradition.
Sorry, you, Roger.
Some of us have been reading about Ludwig Wittgenstein, and I've been trying to find out, did he actually ever study Buddhist or any Eastern philosophy? I can't find any evidence.
I've never run into any evidence, but most of my Wittgenstein reading was many years ago. I don't know. He certainly would have been aware of it, but I think he was less aware of it than many other contemporary or modern philosophers. There's obviously some very interesting similarities going on. In fact, when I was teaching at the University of Michigan many years ago, there was a group of graduate students whose advisor, Luis Gomez, simply referred to them as Casa Wittgenstein, because they seem to be reading more Wittgenstein than Buddhism. There's a book, as you may know, by Chris Goodmanson, Wittgenstein and Buddhism. So some interesting things to be done there.
This will probably need to be the last question.
Okay.
There was an article in the news that spoke to the instinct of friendliness between species and how it engenders trust. We all was caught it, and we read that it will is caught in the horrible net. And spotted the ship and came over to the ship, a small ship, and for some reason had a friendly feeling and a certain amount of trust. And the people on the ship were the right people. They got devices for breaking the message. The whale had to come back to the ship half a dozen times or more so they could break more of the net. So it kind of got free. It was a female and a calf waiting there too. And she didn't have to look what she said. She replied. It was just that, there are infinite stories about friendliness and trust between species, but that was really one of my heart.
Yeah. Nice note on which to end.
Nice.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.